with those with dirty cold to go, been cold since cold flow. Got a wire to enlarge and I set a fire down below. I hang it up when you say sorry, didn't know. Probably got a year 10 to go, so let's go. I don't really know how to go slow.
Welcome, listeners, to another podcast from the Anti-Racist Educator. We are a collective of educators raising critical consciousness about race in Scotland and beyond. My name is Hashim, and today we've got a very, very special guest with us. As acclaimed poet, playwright, and performer, it's Hannah Lavery. Hi, Hannah. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm warm and hay fevery.
But, oh, yeah, I've got the hay fever.
It's so nice to have you on, Hannah. I think our thinking was, over the past couple of weeks, there's been lots and lots of chat about race and racism across the world, obviously, but then turning the lens back on us in Scotland. We're in Glasgow, you're over in the East Coast, right?
Yep, that's right, I'm out in Dunbar.
So there have been lots of different conversations about how we take those ideas about interrogating our past and our present. And what I was thinking is that your work, for me, and just chatting to you from being at the Scottish Poetry Library, really kind of embodies that. So it'd be good to chat about it even more. I thought, just to start us off, could you tell us a bit about yourself and how maybe you work and comment on race and racism through it?
Okay, so my name is Hannah Lavery. I grew up in Edinburgh, so I'm a poet and a playwright now, was a teacher in the past. In terms of, I think, for me, I wrote a kind of spoken word play about 3 or 4 years ago now. I think I started writing it after my father died. And my dad grew up in Edinburgh in the 50s and 60s and was a black man growing up in Scotland in Edinburgh. And I think when he died, it was a kind of, as part of my grief and exploration of our relationship, I had to, I suppose, look at his experience of growing up in Scotland and his experience of racism. And then that kind of allowed me, I suppose, to talk about my own sort of experiences around that and my son. So I think it was about that was my first sort of real bit of writing where I wanted to sort of address the idea of Scottish exceptionalism, think about what it is to belong, like, and that idea of being of colour and being of Scottish being in some ways a real search for a belonging or find, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's where I began, really, and then to start to talk about race or write about race. And then I kind of led into being asked to write The Lament for Sheikhu Bayo, which was about what happened to Sheikhu Bayo and his death in police custody, but also reflecting kind of wider again on Scotland's racism and its denial of it, and how sometimes as a person of colour you feel like you live or your experience of Scotland is different from the experience of white Scottish people, and then the idea that your experiences are not validated or not listened to or recognised. So I think that's where my work's been around that recently.
Yeah, it's all like really, really interesting, like vital stuff that you're talking about. And yeah, it seems that there's been a kind of, over the past few years, maybe it's because I haven't been listening hard enough before, like people are talking more about legacies of race and racism, colonialism, and also, as you're saying, with you and your family, your dad's, like, the everyday experiences and how you kind of navigate identity and stuff. So I think we'll get into that a lot more. We're talking through Lament for Sheikhu Bayo, your play that you wrote, and a piece from The Drift, a poem at the end, Scotland, You're No Mine. We'll post links to all of these to find more information, and the full poem that we'll list is available on the internet for you to read. But I thought it would be good just to start, before looking at your work in specific, to chat about the past couple of weeks and how there's been this groundswell of people coming and expressing anti-racist sentiment. And it feels like after the killing of George Floyd, and the massive protests that have erupted across the United States, across the UK, certainly one in Glasgow. I heard there was one in Edinburgh also.
Yeah.
So everyone's out. So it's people of colour and their white allies are talking about race and racism in a way that feels has not been done for a long, long time. And I think one of the things, I think lots of things that we're thinking about is we've got all these new white allies and we have all these big announcements from all the institutions and big powers that be throughout society that we need to do something about it. I was just interested, what are your thoughts about all of this conversation that has come out of the horrific killing of George Floyd and the protests after it? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I have lots of thoughts. And they swing, I think, from feeling like this is a moment of optimism to feeling, not that less hopeful, but just feeling a bit worn down by it and a bit exhausted by this sort of emotional toil, these sort of conversations that people suddenly want to have with you.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes finding that quite difficult to have the energy for it. But knowing that these little moments, that these kind of cracks in the door, you know, you have to sort of push on through when you're given them. And I think that there is a moment here. This feels to be an acceptance in some places that racism exists in Scotland. And that, I think, is for our country quite a moment, because it's been something that, you know, I remember speaking to someone from the States who said that you wouldn't have to say in the States that it's a racist country. Like, that's just accepted, that's given. Whereas in Scotland, when you talk about racism, it's not always a given that racism exists. You have to, you know, it's about, it always seems like you're having to talk about your experiences to justify your want to change things, you know, that you have to kind of bring out your trauma to convince people.
It feels like such a low bar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We just have to have that conversation first of all, that it does exist.
Yeah, and so the fact that maybe we don't need to have that conversation and we can move on to other conversations and move on to looking at ways in which we tackle racism and tackle institutional racism. I mean, if that's what this has brought us to the next stage of that conversation, then it is a moment to feel hopeful for, or to be hopeful about the future. And I suppose, though I think it has been quite exhausting and emotionally exhausting for many people of colour, this whole moment, I think once that we recover from that, I think we may find ourselves in a new place in which we are believed in the first instance when we talk about racism, and then mm-hmm. have people that want to do something to be allies or to educate themselves.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that in the past few weeks, I've felt in myself like almost more confident to talk about race at work. So I work in a primary school in Glasgow, and it's a school where people are quite willing already to talk about race, which was quite like refreshing.
Mm.
And I felt that before, when people would, or before George Floyd was killed and all the protests happened, when people talked about challenging racism, people were looking for like a lesson plan, a wee pack of things that they can deliver on like one term, and then the next term they won't talk about it again. Whereas now, people are like coming to me, like, granted, these are a lot of white people coming to me, a person of colour, looking to like educate them, which I'm sure like everyone knows that feeling, and what you were saying of like being that kind of font of knowledge when sometimes we don't know as much as everyone thinks we do.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes we're learning as well. And I think, you know, that has to, I wrote a line in Lament for Sheikh Bayo, or I write a line where there's a scene between basic sort of that conversation where you're trying to explain to somebody that Scotland is racist and they're denying it, and then gets to a point where one of them says, well, what do I do about it then? You know, and it just feels like, well, why why do you think it's my job to tell you? Like, why do you think I have the answers? racism, the problem of racism is a person of color's problem. We don't need to have the answers.
I think that also betrays an ignorance of not, or shows that people don't, as in white people don't get that they are part of it and that they benefit from it. Mm. So I think there's been like little wee windows in that, little but still relying on like our like labour and like knowledge and experience, which is like quite often not like recognised, but maybe in this moment is, and looking for like some kind of like guide, I suppose, like people are looking for us to guide them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's difficult because I think, you know, as educators, as I once was, and as a writer, I suppose in some ways I still think I am, and as a writer, you know, it is part of my job to be that guide in some ways, you know, if I'm going to be talking about it. So I kind of, it is welcome when people ask me, you know, like it's a welcome question. I don't, you know, what can we do or what should I do or how do I educate myself? It is a welcome question. It's just sometimes overwhelming, and sometimes I don't have the answer. Yeah, or don't know exactly where to point them.
I know. I think like people don't get that. Me and you may have like thought about race and racism and even done like reading into it for a long time, and yet we still probably don't have. Well, I know I still have so much learning to do, but yeah, people will hopefully take this moment to go into a longer stage of learning about race and racism. One can hope.
No, I was just thinking, it's like, you know, maybe what's come out of this is that lack of, you know, people, often when you talk about racism or you talk about white privilege or you talk about institutional racism, you often sort of prepare yourself, or you often receive quite a defensive position where someone feels attacked, that it feels like it's personal and, you know, that I'm not a racist kind of answer. And actually what I'm finding, or what I'm hoping, is that won't be the response. It will be more of a, I need to educate myself response. It will be, let me go in and find out why I feel that's not true and why that is true. You know, those sort mm-hmm. of kind of questioning of ourselves. I'm hoping that some of that will happen, so it doesn't feel like it's when you point out kind of racism or unconscious bias behavior. I think I got myself confused there, but you know, when you point out racist behavior, mm-hmm. which is perhaps coming from an unconscious place, that person may actually use that as an opportunity to learn, rather than feeling attacked or feeling that they need to defend themselves or prove you wrong. And I think that could be quite a moment, actually. And I think some of these conversations are happening, which is, I've kind of witnessed those kind of online and within my own friendship groups, that people are starting to take those challenges as a kind of positive moment.
I think that leads us into quite nicely talking about some of your work that you've done. So I thought that we would talk first of all about Lament for Sheku Bayou, which is a play. Remind us, when did this play come out?
Well, it hasn't really come out in a way. It was done as a rehearsed read. I was commissioned to write it last year, and it was performed as a rehearsed reading at the Edinburgh International Festival last year. So yeah, so that's when it kind of was first taken out, but it hasn't been put into a full production yet. If that
makes okay, sense. Okay. Is the hope that it would at some point?
I'm hoping so, and I think there's a definite will to make it happen. It's just obviously we're in a new time right now of theatre. It's quite a difficult, you know, things, productions and different ways of thinking about things, how things are happening. It was going to be part of the festival this year, but obviously that's not happening anymore. So
yeah.
But the play, I was asked to So David Gregg and the Lyceum, we were having a conversation, and it came off the back of me writing The Drift, and we were talking about Sheku and what happened to Sheku Bayo. And through that conversation, I was commissioned to write a lament. And in that sort of tradition of the lament, of a kind of poetic mourning for a man or a person. And so it kind of was written with that intention to lament a man. And what the way I approached it was I wanted to get to know him the way I could only get to know him now, which was through what was reported, and to absorb all of that. And that's kind of the what resulted was quite was a quite poetic piece, but also that had a lot of reportage in it. So it had it has the reports and the kind of transcripts and things that I managed to find that were all kind of publicly available. And I think the question I began with that was, when I told someone I was writing this, and whenever I talked about it, the most often response was, Sheku, who? Who's that? Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that. And the shock of then discovering it happened in Kikodi, and the way he died, and then quite often a disbelief that this couldn't have, that the police were at fault, really. You know, the idea this is not America, that doesn't happen here. You must have got that wrong. If it was like that, we'd have heard about it. You know, these sort of kind of responses.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was thinking, well, actually, the information is out there. You know, there's documentaries, there's newspaper articles. You can go and look at it yourself. And if you spent, you know, a few days reading all the material that's publicly available, then you may, you know, the conclusion you've come to is kind of what I offered, which was something terrible happened. There was terrible mistakes, terrible intentions made, and presumptions, and, you know, racial profiling, and this man did not need to die. And then I wanted to talk about the fact that he was, you know, what I saw in the photographs that his family released was a man who was loved, a man who was a father and a partner and a son. And that felt really important for me to talk about him in those ways, because he was talked about by the police as being a sort of super, you know, the kind of superhuman black man.
Monster. It's just like lots of like racial tropes like coming out that you might hear from like a different place. You might assume would happen in a different country, but then the same things are being brought in here. Just to give a bit of background for people that might not know about what happened to Sheku Bayo, just before we talk about a bit more in detail about maybe what it was like to make it and maybe the reaction now in the past few weeks. Sheku Bayo, he was a man who came from Sierra Leone to Scotland as a young teenager. Was working in Scotland, was father of two, and had a partner, was living in Kirkcaldy, near to his sister. And then it was on the 3rd of May 2015, there was a call about a man in the street brandishing a large knife, which obviously never was the case. And lots of police came to intervene. And in the struggle, there was lots of police who were on top of him. And if you have a look at any of the news pieces, you'll see all the injuries that he sustained and was ultimately killed by the police in that incident. And then after that, there's been many, many years. It was this more than 5 years ago now. There was on the anniversary of that, there was a good talk from his family on the day of one of the marches about what happened, and from Amar Anwar, and there's lots of reminding that in the beginning he was killed by the police, and then there was a willful, obfuscation of what happened, and the police, for example, had lots of days to come up with their statement, coordinate their statements. It transpired that one of the police officers had been known to make like openly racist statements towards black people and said that he hated them. That was his own brother-in-law that came out to the news and said that. And we can see even from powers that be now, there's still some element of denial that race played a part. Now it was announced towards the end of last year that Hamza Yusuf will launch an inquiry to look at the handling of Sheikh Abayu's killing and see what kind of role race did play in that. So that's briefly what happened. You wrote and put on at the International Festival what sounds like a really fascinating play. Has there been any more, or have you been approached more about what you wrote and about Sheikh Abayu in the past couple of weeks, given what happened to George Floyd and the renewed interest? Kind of interest is a strange word to use, but people are talking about Sheikh in a way that they weren't years ago.
I mean, people are talking about, I mean, they're not probably talking about him as much as they should, but they're definitely talking about Sheikh Abayu as being our George Floyd. I mean, Sheikh was, you know, an eyewitness said that Sheikh Abayu was shouting for the police to get off him, and they, you know, they sat on him for a period of time. I think it was around about 5 minutes, and he was shouting for them to get off, very much like, you know, like George Floyd with "I Can't Breathe." So that was 5 years ago, and the family have not had any answers and any justice, I would say. And though there is a public inquiry, no one will ever, from my understanding, will ever be charged. And that's, you know, the tragedy at the heart of that. So the last few weeks I have been, I was honoured that I was asked by their family lawyer to speak at an online protest, a couple of weekends ago. And I have been asked to, you know, there is talk about, I know there's a real want to, we wanted to put it on, the plan was to, the Lyceum were going to support to put it on this year at the International Festival as a production. And there's talk of, we're talking about ways in which that it might get a light of day. We'll have to see what comes from that, but I certainly think that that there has been, you know, people are obviously talking about him more in that case, and what that means for us as well, what it means that, you know, when we try and talk about ourselves, and Scotland does talk about itself in a certain way, that how can we talk about ourselves as this kind of liberal, tolerant place when 5 years on a family are still seeking answers and have been treated in terms of the way Sheikh was talked about in the releases by the, you know, that have been shocking. So yeah, it's definitely been something I've been asked about recently, and it's been something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I think, you know, it was hard to hear about George Floyd and not think about Sheikh Abayu, and that was difficult to kind of, and I imagine for his family must have been absolutely devastating to sort of see even a clip of what happened to George, because it's hard not to and not think about what happened to Sheikh Abayu on a street in Kirkcaldy, you know.
I think I hope that this kind of renewed interest, even though it's not anywhere near what the case deserves, does end up in, you know, this inquiry being like fruitful.
As well, it's not just even just about the inquiry, it's the fact that we show up, you know, like so many people have been protesting Black Lives Matter and going out and protesting at the moment, and I just really hope that when the public inquiry, and I know that Caddy, his sister, asked for this, was that when they have the public inquiry, that we show that those people that were protesting in Edinburgh and Glasgow and all around the country, go and stand outside the public inquiry, make sure that this family get the answers they need. And I think that is, that's what I hope too, is that we should not, obviously that I hope the public inquiry changes something, but also the fact that we show up and show up for that family and show up for, that we, you know, that we, if we're going to say and say Black Lives Matter, then we have to say it beyond when it's a hashtag, and we have to still keep showing up. And it feels like that will be the moment for me to know whether people have really mean what they have been saying recently, will be whether people show up at that inquiry.
Yeah, it's absolutely vital. I think that kind of brings us into the next thing I thought we could talk about, which was one of your poems in a collection called The Drift, called Scotland, You're No Mine. And this poem, from what I saw, was nominated for one of the best Scottish poems last year.
Yes, it did. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, absolutely, like, wonderful poem. I looked it up when I was preparing for this podcast and, like, thinking about it and thinking about how much it says, like, shines a light on what racism is thought of in Scotland, how people perceive it, and maybe how people perceive it is maybe not a thing. Now, here's Hannah Lavery reading out for us, Scotland, You're No Mine.
Scotland, you're no mine. Scotland, you're no mine. You are no his. And I don't want you. So go ahead. Say I don't belong. With your sepia-tinged cross eye, sweeping over all that swept away, blood-stained, sweat-stained sugar for your tablet, your macaroon, you rotten, gobby, greedy, thieving bastard, you. Sitting atop all that shite and broken bones, weeping, poor me. Fuck you. I will dance jigs on your flags, blue, white and red, it doesn't matter, but your wee chancer. Fuck. For making us complicit, handing us whip and chains, an officer's coat, a civil service pen, a queen to love, and lay me out. I love you. With all your mountain tyne and your curian, and you can say I didn't belong to you. Go on. But I am limpet stuck on you, so fuck you for not seeing one of your own. I will hear, I will spill here my blood and your secrets, bleed into you, root and earth, and you, forever pagan, will, in the spill and the seep, see all you really are. So fuck you, my sweet, forgetful Caledonia, we love. Fuck you.
Can you tell us what your idea was behind this and maybe how you came to writing it?
Well, this poem was part of The Drift, the spoken word show, and it's it's part of a pamphlet I published called Finding Sea Glass, which are the poems, or some of the poems from that spoken word show. And Scotland is an interesting poem because in some ways it's part of that context of that grief and about my dad. So that the anger in that poem is not just mine, I think. And I think of it as a love poem because it's that feeling that I felt growing up, that I feel when I'm having to sort of define where I'm from and who I am, that and the longing to belong, to be told that you're welcome, and also then the anger that you feel you have to ask for it anyway because you don't belong anywhere else. So there's all that stuff going on in it, and it kind of has references back to Scotland's kind of role in slavery and Scotland's role in colonialism. So it has all that. So it's quite a layered poem that way. But I think if I was to describe it, I would say it was a love poem to Scotland.
I think that for me is one thing that really, really stuck out, like, throughout, and then in the last couple of lines, so fuck you, my sweet forgetful Caledonia. It was something that, like, talks to me, and I think probably a lot of people that grew up in Scotland and who are not, like, white, thinking that, yeah, it's a beautiful country and there's so much to love about it and it does feel like home in so many ways, but it's such a torment at the same time.
And I think for me as well, when you've come, you know, many people in Scotland who aren't white Scots or people of colour Scots, I think with the definition that we want to use, often are coming from a colonial past. So for me, my kind of DNA stretches to Jamaica and to India. When you look back, when you follow that back to Jamaica, or when you follow that back to India, you bump into quite a lot of Scots along the way. So, and you know, Jamaica has, I think, has more Scottish surnames than Scotland does, you know, in the phone book. So when I kind of realized that when I went back to followed my Jamaican family back, that we had a Scottish surname, and I never questioned that till kind of fairly recently, when I understood about slavery and how the Scots were involved in slavery and involved and had such a heavy presence in Jamaica. And I suddenly went, oh, that's why we have that surname. And then kind of then their journey from Jamaica to Burma and to India, and then kind of the kind of Anglo-Indian sort of and family, that all of these connections lead back to Britain and to Scotland. So when people say that you don't belong or you're not part of the history of this country, it's just nonsense. And it makes me so angry that people can say that. And you go, well, of course I'm part of the history of this country. Scotland does not stop at its borders, you know, and Scotland stretches out. So to say that Scottishness is not part of Jamaica's history, or Jamaica's not part of Scotland's history, or India's not part of Scotland's history, and Scotland's not part of, you know, all of this stuff is just a lack. It's such an ignorance, and so I think that was kind of part of the rage of that poem as well, is that you know, this idea of you know, and this is why I think like history is so important and education is so important, because yeah, Scotland does not stop at the borders. It does not stop at the border.
No, yeah, we're totally imbricated into that empire, like that people down south may have come closer to acknowledging that, you know, slavery was a thing and like our prosperity is based upon that.
And Scotland benefited, I think I've got this right, that Scotland benefited from slavery per capita more than any other country in Europe. And that, you know, when you think about that, and that isn't just the richest of the rich, that goes all the way through Scotland, that benefit of slavery and the benefit of colonialism. I mean, you know, we're built on that. So, yeah, and I think that, I get so upset when I think about how long it took me to learn this history. You know, it took me such a long time to know about this, and I feel like if I'd known it earlier, it would have really been a powerful knowledge for me to understand myself and to feel my feet were stronger on the ground here. Do you know what I mean?
And
I
think, yeah, I mean, I
just took me too long to learn. I didn't learn until I was in my late 30s. You know.
I know. I think it's inconceivable almost, like when you read about this stuff when you're by yourself or when you're with a group of people who are like geared towards being critical about the past in a way that didn't happen in our own classrooms. It feels like an injustice almost, and you think, how could we have not talked about this in any way whatsoever when we were growing up? It's like, yeah, it's such a massive gap, and like there's like little things in the poem that stood out for me is like the sweat stained sugar for your tablet, like that thing that's seen as so Scottish, as you were saying, doesn't, as you're also saying, stop at the border. Like, where did that sugar come from? How did we build these like national institutions which are seen as like more Scottish than anything, but they came off the back of, you know, slave labor, and we were a part of that, and we can't just like close the door and say that it's stopped, where people that might be critical of toppling statues across the country, but it still lives with us today. And like, even if you take a walk through Glasgow, and I'm sure if you took a walk through Edinburgh as well, you could like point to any number of things which like point out that history and anything in our normal daily lives that show that, yeah, we were part of the empire, we were massively disproportionately represented in it.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you're so right, and I think that idea, when you said that thing about injustice, I think that is really it. It isn't it, but it is, and it's an injustice for us all, you know. And it's like, and also I think I'm starting to think as well, as I kind of move forward from the drift as well, thinking about that history, just, you know, that idea that history stopped at slavery, there's more in there, you know, that I want to discover now the richness and the joy of that as well. I think so much recently has been about the kind of the pain and the trauma of some of these stories, but there's so much joy and resilience and powerful, beautiful things about being mixed race or being, you know, from a kind of multi-diverse kind of background. I think we should be celebrating the joy of that too, and looking at how positive that is. And so I'm in both places, if that makes sense. But that injustice, just that really, that's really the key. I think we need desperately to bring that into education, but bring that into just our understanding of ourselves, that we're so interconnected, and we have so much history that stretches right across the world, and and we need to know about it. We need to know about it to know ourselves, and to be able to treat each other from that place. I mean, I was thinking when I was at school, the only anti-racist type, or not anti-racist, but the only kind of education or history I got around race was the kids getting bussed to school in the civil rights movement, and, you know, it was Rosa Parks, it was mm-hmm. Martin Luther King, and there was never anything about, you know, Britain at all.
I know, and then, like, we had the same things too, and then, like, I learnt about people in the UK getting bussed into schools, like, kids down south in London, and like, they got bussed to different districts because there was too many Asian kids in, like, certain schools.
Oh, I didn't hear about that. No, I never got that. I just got it in America.
Yeah, I mean, like, the same things happened here, but obviously in the States it was like, we need to make sure the quota is right, so it's, like, it's balanced, maybe. Whereas here, I don't think it was quite the same in Scotland, but down south, like, there were too many brown people in certain areas, so they had to get bussed out to different places. And I just thought, wow, we talk about things that happen thousands and thousands of miles away, but we've never turned the gaze inwards, as it were, and thought, yeah, the same things were happening here, but there's not so much will to talk about it.
I think as well, it's not the skill to talk about it. I mean, I was, I trained as a teacher, and I remember a few things through my training that what struck me was that the teachers, maybe there wasn't the will to have those conversations, but two, they just didn't have the skill to deal with it, to deal with what might be the ramifications mm-hmm. of having that sort of conversation.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, how do they negotiate that within the classroom? What's their own knowledge? And there was a real fear of beginning a debate that they didn't know how to control, or I don't know if I'm quite coming out right, but yeah, I did feel that there was a lack of skill around that, and a bit of fear about starting something that they didn't know how to bring to a positive end, you know, like, it just felt too terrifying, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a kind of there's an overwhelming want to, like, avoid any kind of discomfort. I suppose talking about race and racism is a very very uncomfortable thing, and I remember in my own teacher training that people in our big tutorial room would talk about not wanting to feel uncomfortable for the lesson, and then I and other people pointed out, well, it's great that you can only feel uncomfortable for half an hour. We need to feel uncomfortable all the time, so you can have it for a little bit. It's much better that way. And then I'm sure we can work together on it in some way afterwards.
No, yeah, no, I definitely, you know, I remember it. Yeah, I remember being told it when I was training to be a teacher that when we did our unit on pupil diversity, I think. Was it called? Yeah, I think we had a unit called pupil diversity that we didn't really have to pupil difference, maybe it was called. We didn't have to discuss race because it wasn't an issue in Scotland unless you were going to teach in Glasgow. Yeah, just wasn't worth doing. Wow. Yeah, it was completely the teacher, the tutorial. Yeah, he just sort of said, "There's no, we don't have to talk about that."
Oh my God.
And I remember trying to say in the class that as growing up, where I was, maybe I think maybe there was three children who are of colour, that actually it's in some ways I used to long to be in a school where it was loads, you know, because it just felt, you felt so alone having to negotiate that just on your own. And you were desperate for someone to teach your classmates about that stuff, because you were having to try and teach them yourself. And when you're like eight or six and you're getting kind of racist abuse in the playground, it's quite lonely if there's, you're the only one receiving it, you know, and you don't know how to, nobody's talking about it.
And there's teachers who are not equipped to either recognise it or deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still think that's the case. I still think that, you know, I've got kind of stories of my own son, and when asked about how they were going to report the racist bullying, were just kind of, you know, it was described as name calling. It was described as every, you know, it's just about seeing, it's just because he's a bit, you know, everyone, kids always look at what's different, and it's just bullying. And, you know, his parents are appalled. You know, it was all very much, don't make a fuss about this, and you're the one that's causing the problem. And then we've had it all sorted out now, and it's not a deal. And we're not, you know, and like, are you going to report this on the official, you know, council statistics, and just not get an answer? So it's still very much that kind of, I think, yeah, I think it's, it feels too big for teachers to deal with. So it's much easier to talk about Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, but not talk about it being within your own country or school, or, you know.
Yeah, it reminds you of, like, just what you're talking about. I'm reading a book. You might have heard of it, Afropean, by Johnny Pitts.
No, I haven't.
It came out last year. It's been, like, nominated for different prizes and stuff, so I just saw it and just bought it because it was bigged up by lots of big people.
Okay, I'm going to put that in my list.
Yeah, you should. It's a travel memoir, a travel account of going through Europe, and he is a mixed-raced man from Sheffield, and he works his way through Europe going through different black communities. And one thing he reflects on is that, like, a lot of people in all these different black communities and the white communities around them are very able to look at racism in other places. So, for example, he says exactly the same thing as you, that people in the UK have a great knowledge about, like, race and racism in the States. And, like, I can even say that for myself. I think I know more about race and racism there than I do about it here in Scotland. And that it's much easier to kind of dislocate yourself and feel that you don't have to confront those, like, structural things that you've had to live through, but let look at them through a different lens. And I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I remember it's reason why when I was kind of younger and having to deal with like, became a teenager, you know, you're having to deal with that sort of everyday kind of racism, I remember just like listening to a lot of like NWA and Public Enemy and just finding a sort of kind of home there, because it felt like that they were talking about something that on some level I understood or could try and find some kind of power within that for my own kind of consciousness raising. And isn't it, I mean, you know, eventually I found, like, kind of, remember listening to a lot of Lindsay and Crazy Johnson and kind of got into the poetry and dub and specials and stuff. Like, I kind of found it later, but initially it was that sort of America's kind of where I went to find a voice, really, in a way to kind of express how I felt about having to deal with lots of little everyday things and bigger things and feeling like I didn't belong anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to Tupac when I was like seven, so I know exactly what you're saying. I probably shouldn't have been listening to it, but for some reason,
yeah, it's probably not something we should recommend to 7-year-olds. But no. I definitely, with my son, we listen to a lot of the specials as our kind of,
yeah, good.
It's definitely something.
Yeah, I think that may be more suitable for the curriculum than Tupac.
I don't know.
But it called out to me, and I'd even to this day, I'm thinking, like, why that, and not like Blur or something.
It was a definite finding something that mirrors your own anger, your own kind of sense of injustice felt really kind of an important thing, or kind of a place of recognition or something that I couldn't find within any of the culture that I was being presented through school. There was mm-hmm. nothing really that I felt I recognised. And I think that when, I remember when we looked at Scottish literature, when we looked at Scottish history at school, there was nothing in there that I recognised as having anything to do with me. You know, it just felt like it was, it wasn't part of who I was.
I know.
And I think if it had been put in a context of empire or colonialism or slavery, then I would be able to have made those connections to that history. Do you know what? And I just felt, and it would, yeah, it would have embraced me as a student in the classroom, and I would have felt less alone. And I think I would have been able to share that sense of being part of what Scotland as an idea is with my white classmates, because we would have all been part of that that enterprise, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of like deep honesty is something that students, learners of like all ages can like definitely appreciate when they see it.
I mean, think like in terms of being a writer, I think it's something that I've been, I think maybe that's probably one of the things that motivates me in recent years to write about Scotland and to address those issues. I think it is probably on some level writing something for me then as well as for me now, and for, and yeah, so I think the Scotland poem comes from all of those places, I think.
Yeah, I'll have to chat to you. I've been doing some writing of my own, thinking about, it's kind of that's the same thing. I've been writing a lot about like Paul Shields, like the area I grew up in and went to school, like for some reason I'm always going back there. Brings me on to like a final, maybe a very big question that I would be very interested to hear what you think. So Scotland You Know Mine is talking a lot about that kind of love and also like anger in the same breath about our like national story and how much of it doesn't like chime with reality. So do you have any ideas about how we could, or how we need to reconceptualise that story to then move forward to a more racially just country?
Well, I suppose in some ways it's really obvious things, like making sure that we teach to the Scotland that we're in, you know, and make sure that our history is properly told. But I think there's also something that I think is really important, is that we have to think of a culture or of a country not being a fixed thing. It's a constantly changing and evolving thing. And we have to let that... Sorry, I've just swallowed something. We have to think about, you know, is culture being something that can... Our culture can be something which can embrace many different voices, and allowing all of those to exist and to be honoured. You know, I think that's kind of where I'm hopeful for, like if I was trying to, you know, but I think it's also just making sure that justice is done when there's injustice, and like the case of Sheikha Bayo, like making sure that in the workplace that stuff around equality legislation is actually enacted, and that people feel they can speak up and speak out, and realising that building a tolerant, and building, not even tolerant, I hate the word tolerant, I don't want to be tolerated, but building, you know, but
bring me in.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
Or not even bring me in, just like give me what is owed to me. Yeah.
I'm not, it's no favours. Mm-hmm. It's not like, actually I was thinking the other day about how many times, like, what do I find more difficult? The question, where are you from? Where are you really from? Or how are you enjoying Scotland? Or you're very welcome. And I think about all the times I've been said, oh, you're very welcome in Scotland to people. I'm thinking, no. I've lived here all my life. You don't have to welcome me to a place that is already mine. But yeah, I think it's about just, I don't know. It's a really difficult one, isn't it? But I just kind of, I hope that we can just find a way of listening to each other, I think, and believing people's experiences, and realizing to love your country, or to love where you're from, or to want the best for your neighbours and your community, that can't happen until you're honest about who you are. And you can't move from the place you are until you really know where it is that you are. You know, and I think this denial of anything negative about ourselves stops us from ever going forward. And I think I feel like that is probably the starting point. You know, how we get to where we want to be, I don't know.
I mean, it's such a big thing, but totally agree with like everything you said there. It's great. Thank you so much, Hannah. It's been a really cool chat. Thanks so much for coming on, taking time out of your day and talking about lots of like quite difficult stuff. But it was an absolute pleasure.
No, it was fun actually. It was really nice to and I'm so supportive of what you're doing. So you know,
thank you so much. How can people find you on the internet, Hannah, if they were to look up you and your work?
I have a fancy website, so I mean, I don't know if it's fancy, but it's fancy looking to me. So it's Hannah Lavery. You can Google me. I think it's co.uk or maybe it's com. I can't remember.
It's com actually. I've got it up.
So yes. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, which is Han Lavery, and then I've got a website which kind of you can get in touch with me or tells you all the things I'm doing, and it gives you a link to my pamphlet, which has the Scotland poem in it as well. Yeah, so that's how you can find me. And I'm also the learning coordinator at the Scottish Poetry Library, if you're interested in learning things. So, yeah.
I think a lot of our listeners will be. Thank you so much. And thank you everyone who has been listening. Another great episode. Stay tuned for more episodes in the next few weeks. We're hoping to talk to more people who are concerned, just as we've been talking about today, about state racism in Scotland. And also in the future, a few episodes about critical pedagogy and practical ways of bringing anti-racist education into the classroom. So thank you so much. Can't wait to see you again. Please like, share, subscribe. Bye.